probably 8 to 10 hours of testimony on a number of bills, and we finally came to a bill that we really believed that would work to get at some of the things that Senator Lim wanted to get at. The commission basically is in favor of this bill, though the commissioners generally take a neutral stance, and they did so on this bill at their May commission meeting. There are a number of provisions here.
I should have asked staff to give the committee a general overview of the bill before you jumped into it too far.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I think Ms. Hudson will probably do an excellent job summarizing this bill for you. Mm-hmm. This directs the OLCC to establish uniform standards in the minor decoy program to investigate unlawful sales to minors. And the bill is much more detailed in that regard as far as what kind of guidelines they need to use to set some criteria for them. Also, there are a whole bunch of amendments at your place. I hope you have all of them. There are dash A7s from the Restaurant Association. There are dash A8s that resolve conflicts. There are dash A10s from Senator Lim, which is a technical change to the bill that didn't get put in on the Senate side. And dash A11s from the grocers. And all those will be addressed by the various witnesses.
Okay.
I could, again, for the record, Bart Hutchinson. The decoy standards that are set out here are something that the commission has already been doing. We have published them. We've shared them with local law enforcement throughout the state. We think this is a good bill. There's one section that we had some difficulty with. There was some language that was ambiguous, and we have some amendments that should clarify that. The only other thing I might mention is that this treats liquor licensees differently. It gives different privileges to package store licensees and tougher privileges to, or less privilege to on-site or on-premise licensees as it relates to the minor decoy program. What I would like to be able to do is, as you go through the amendments, to speak to each one, as some of them are okay with the commission, some we're very much in favor of, and some we've got a little bit of concern with. You want me to stay up here or just I'll come back up?
Yes, so Mr. McCallum will be testifying on the dash 11. Well, he's got the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike McCallum with the Oregon Restaurant Association, and we're in support of 115 as it comes to, and also in support of the A7 amendment. And this amendment is one that would simply allow liquor store owners to deliver their products to licensees, in other words, my members. Currently, we have to go from our restaurants, bars, and taverns to the Liquor Commission stores and pick it up and take it back to our establishment. This amendment would simply say if those store owners wanted to, they could deliver it to us instead of having us pick it up. It doesn't say they have to. It just simply says that they can if they want to. And there are certain liquor stores who would like that privilege.
Barbara Peterson, for the record, the commission doesn't have a problem with this. We really look at it as a customer service issue. And the commission will still have the ability to set the parameters around how this works so that one particular liquor agent couldn't create a monopoly and push some of the smaller agents out of business.
Any questions from the committee for Mr. McCallum?
Thank you
very much. Well, it's Brian Bow, ORCA, or might be a public to have Steve McCoy come up first on the Dash 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Steve McCoy, here representing the Oregon Grocery Industry Association, and we're here to discuss with you the Dash 11 amendments to Senate Bill 115. What these amendments would do, and I should say before we start that a number of us lobbied members of the committee this morning, and at that point said that it told you as part of our lobbying effort that the commission had no problem and was supportive of these amendments. That was our understanding as of the close of business Friday and as of the opening of business Monday. But an 11 o'clock phone call from the chair of the commission has got us to the point where, as my understanding, the commission is neutral but not necessarily supportive of these amendments. They have no problem with them, but they're not going to come out in support of them. And Ms. Hutchinson can speak to that later. We apologize for any confusion that might have caused, but it was not our intent to mislead anybody in any way. These amendments, very simply, I guess, put in statute something that's been in existence operationally for as long as I've been in the grocery business, which is now going on 27 years, and that's basically the fact that the agents from the liquor stores, as commissioned by the Liquor Control Commission, sell distilled spirits and basically package store licensees, most notably food stores and grocery stores, sell beer and wine. We would like that put in statute as is not there right now. We think that what this basically does is maintain the status quo in the business environment as we know it today and as we've known it for the, like I said, the past at least 27 years that I've been around. And what this does is say that the commission may not, a store operated by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission under the statute may not sell malt beverages and may not sell wine containing less than 15% of alcohol by volume, and then it gives some exceptions. We cover those because malt beverages obviously are the beer, and wine less than 15% is basically the great number of table wines that we sell here. One thing that we were aware of is vermouth, I guess, is a wine, and it's at 18% by volume, and we want to make sure the liquor stores could still sell the vermouth for those folks that enjoy their martinis and whatever else you're using vermouth for. In Section 9, Sub 3, the commission may issue a package store license to an agent appointed by the commission for the purpose of sales of malt beverage and wines on premises shared with the commission store if, and we've got A there, the store makes gross sales of distilled liquors of less than, we would suppose that we put in $1 million in a calendar year there, and that's after discussion with the commission. They're happy with that and agree with that number. And B, the store is not designated by the commission on the effective date of this act as an exclusive store that is limited to sales of distilled liquors and other items specified by commission rule. And if that's what we're trying to do here, is say those stores that are exclusive stores that have been selling hard liquor, and that's what they do for a living, they're going to have to keep selling just distilled spirits and not get into malt beverages and wine. And in some rural areas where the volume isn't adequate, for lack of a better word, to really support that as a going business of its own, we've got these exceptions so that they can, in fact, be designated to sell other beverages. In fact, that's the only way you're going to be able to service a small community, a rural area, or a rural area that doesn't really have enough of a population base to support just a regular liquor store. So we've tried to, and it is our understanding after working with the commission, looking at their numbers on who are the exclusive stores and who are the non-exclusive stores, all those non-exclusive stores are those stores that today are not only authorized to sell distilled spirits but other products, including malt beverages and wine in some places, will still be able to do that. On the other hand, those exclusive stores that are selling distilled spirits and those items that the commission allows them to sell also will not be allowed to expand into malt beverages and wine. Again, the status quo, as we've known it, is maintained, and that's all that we're asking to do here is put that in statute. And finally, in Section 10, that basically is a grandfather clause, so that there, if there is any stores, and it's our understanding there's one store in the state that's like that, where the liquor agent also has a package store license and is doing over $1 million in distilled spirit sales a year, that we're not going to fiddle with them, and they're going to be grandfathered in and be allowed to continue as they have been. That's the extent of our amendments. We think, again, this maintains the status quo, and we think it's important for our smaller store members who, in many cases, depend greatly on the sale of beer and wine to compete and exist in the marketplace, that they be allowed to do so. We don't agree that the liquor stores be able to go into beer and wine sales, which, while they're granted now a statutory monopoly, gives them a one step up in the competitive marketplace, because there's no way a convenience store selling only beer and wine can compete with a liquor store that's going to be able to sell distilled spirits, beer and wine, and a variety of other items. It's not a fair thing. We're looking at a status quo. We think in an issue of fairness, this is fair for everybody involved. And again, just puts in statute what's existed in the marketplace for a number of years. And we would ask you to support the A11 amendments.
Any questions for Mr. McCoy?
Mr.
King Kirchig?
Thank you. I'm just curious, has there been a move to change the tab beer and wine sold in the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Piercy, had the opportunity to sit in on a joint or a Ways and Means Subcommittee General Government in which the OLCC budget was there, and there was a budget note. There was a budget note proposed that would look for a study looking into putting beer and wine into liquor stores and study the impact and all these kinds of things that would go into it and report back to the emergency board. We got involved in that, but in further discussions discovered that there was no statutory requirement that the status quo be that way. That's why we're here.
Thank you.
Other questions? Ms. Hutchinson, did you concur with the $1 million on line 15?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Any other comments on that amendment?
The only thing I think our commissioners are concerned about is that they're very hesitant to put into statute this kind of language. It makes them feel a little bit like they've been given the job of running a business, and this takes away some of their flexibility and some of their business tools, if you will. But we can live with this. We can work with the industry to make this work for everybody.
Thank you, Mr. McCoy.
Thank you.
Mr. Bow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Bow, and I'm here this afternoon representing the 235 small businesses that retail distilled spirits on behalf of the state of Oregon. We're opposed to the Dash A11 amendments, and let me give you the full story of just exactly what led to the amendments that are in front of you. The Ways and Means Subcommittee that Mr. McCoy referred to struggled with the OLCC budget up until about a week or two ago, and one of the main issues they struggled with was trying to find an adequate way to compensate the men and women, those small businesses that retail distilled spirits. There have been problems in that regard for many, many years, because to increase the compensation for the liquor agents, you're taking money out of the general fund. And it's pretty hard when you're a small group like they are to go up against schools and health care and those other general fund issues. But one of the ways the committee decided to resolve the issue this time was to direct the agency through a budget note to explore the possibility of adding high-end premium beer and wine sales in a very limited amount to liquor agencies. The thinking was, again, that this would give them an additional related item and help them meet the business expenses that they're having trouble meeting with under the current compensation. The thinking, in addition to that, was it would be very limited and controlled by the agency in terms of the amount of space they're not looking at putting in, and the agency, I know, would never tolerate putting in banks of refrigerator cases to sell Budweiser and the other mainstream lines. They were looking as an adjunct, a collateral sale to distilled spirits of very high quality premium beers and wines. The budget note also went on to direct the agency to investigate putting distilled spirits in grocery stores. So the budget note is very even-handed in terms of it's not saying that we're going to do this and we're not going to do that. It said, let's look at the whole picture. The grocery industry, the big grocers, Safeway and Albertsons, didn't like that, and they tried to get rid of the budget note, but the committee felt very strongly that it needed to be there and that it was an important part of the overall agent's compensation scheme. So we very much would like to see that remain intact and the agency have the ability to explore that. And certainly that means more than adding the high-proof fortified wines such as vermouths or ports or sherries and that kind of thing. This is about adding a very small amount in a very controlled way to these agencies. You know, it's really about fairness. The distilled spirits retailers in this space face a real challenge. Oregon has the second or third highest tax rate on distilled spirits, and that impacts the sales. And conversely, our beer tax, we're 49th in the nation. We have one of the lowest, with the exception of Wyoming, we have the lowest beer tax in the nation. They can't advertise. They're very limited in what they can do. And so, again, I would just urge that you reject the A11 amendment. And finally, I will close by saying I'm a little bit, not to cast any aspersions on Barb or anything, but I'm a little bit confused by the commission's position on this because they fought very hard to keep that budget note in there, allowing them the flexibility to do this with the retail liquor agency. So I'm a little bit confused by their position, but notwithstanding that, I would strongly urge the committee to reject this. The Ways and Means Committee spent hours dealing with this issue, and I think they found a good and reasonable approach to it, and I urge you not to tamper with that. One final thing on the A7 amendments, which also affect agents, Mr. Chair. We're not going to oppose those as long as the agency has the ability to control that. There are some sensitivities about the delivery issue, which I won't burden the committee with now, but we will not oppose the A7 amendments. But we definitely are opposed to the A11 amendments and urge their rejection.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Mr. Bowe?
Yes.
Mr. Pearson.
Did you have a discussion with the grocery industry about if there was any place where you could have agreement over the limited and controlled amount that they could be comfortable with and that you could be comfortable with? Was there any work on that together?
Mr. Chair, Representative Piercy, I didn't know about the existence of the Dash A11 amendments until this morning. I haven't had any discussion with them about this.
Further questions, Mr. Bell? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Lim, sorry to keep you waiting.
Carol, Mr. Chair, can I just ask Carol and the Minister to join me also?
Certainly.
Can I have an amendment? Okay. Thank you very much, Chair Simmons and members of the committee. I do appreciate the hearing the Senate Bill 115A. Once Senate Bill 115A is it's a work product of many hearings and meetings with OLCC, and this is the compromise bill. Oregon Liquor Control Commission and many other local enforcement agencies use minor decoy programs as an enforcement tool to curb the sales of alcohol beverage to the minors. This has been a very effective tool to eliminate selling to the minors from the licenses. Coordination among all minor decoy programs is not required. There is no uniform standard so far to this point and procedures for the program. As a result, OLCC licensee made the target of multiple sting operations that are being conducted by OLCC and also by the local police department. What's more, the licensee may also be subject to more than one sanction for the same violation. The committee believes that the minor decoy program is a valuable enforcement tool that would be improved by coordinating among the sponsors and the use of uniform standards. I want to thank Barbara Hutchinson that has been working with us on this bill. I don't think I'm going to bore you that explaining what the bill does, even though I have written everything. I will just open for any questions if you have any Senate Bill 115, just to save time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Senator Lim from the committee?
Carol, do you have any amendments you have?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
With regard to the Dash 10 amendments, this is just a technical change. In looking at the bill as it's written, A and Gross, Section 2, Subsection 4, the language was a bit broad, and there was a chance under the worst-case scenario that minor decoy operation could be occurring, and in carrying out that operation, they may find that a licensee was stealing drugs or something like that, and in that case, they maybe would have been not been able to cite the person for the drug issues because it was in the middle of a decoy operation. So we've just clarified by adding language that it's a it's done in conjunction with selling alcohol to minors, so that's very clear.
Lynn, you're okay with these?
Yes, I'm okay with that. And if I may say, not only is it okay that the Dash 10, but also the Dash 11, I'm supported to make sure that the state agencies selling that the liquors, they should sell the hot liquor, that the Texas could issue to sell the more beverages such as beer and wine. If they mingle it together, we might have some problem. Unless we privatize the OLCC, just to let them sell whatever they want. Otherwise, the agency should sell hard liquor, and then Texas should sell beer and wine. So there should be a no mingle each other. If one selling the other product, then sometime in the system we'll have a lot of confusion. So I support the measure that the Dash 11 commits.
And as I understand it, the A-A8 resolved conflict, and the 11s of the Restaurant Association.
Yes.
Yeah. And you support that also?
Yes.
I do. Okay. Any last chance questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair,
thank you very much.
I just wanted to add one thing, and that is the commission, in good faith, is going to go through a study to look at both sides of this question, and anything we did could not change the manner in which we do business until we come back to the legislature, A, with a study and a proposal, and it would require some legislative action. So we don't expect anything to really change in the next 18 months, so we see you all again.
Ms. Hutchinson, how would things change based on the Dash 11?
The Dash 11s would allow us, I mean, we could really do it right now. There are certain areas of the state that we believe are underserved. Right now, we could add additional exclusive liquor stores. We are experimenting with what we're calling a boutique liquor store, and that is taking an existing business. The first one we're doing is at Salishan in the marketplace down below the lodge. And it's an existing deli, and I believe they have a package store license as well. They're going to carry high-end scotches, high-end distilled spirits. They will not be providing alcohol to any dispensers, to any of the on-premise people, so it will not be in competition with a regular exclusive liquor store. We believe there may be a market for such things, and this, we are going to go ahead and pursue that sort of, but it probably won't happen until the next biennium.
Do you see these as an impediment?
The commission feels that this does tie our hands a bit in terms of our flexibility. But with the change in moving the amount to $1 million, does help.
Okay. Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 115A, and we'll defer a work session until some more of our members return from some of their activities. And we will go down the list now to go back to the head of the agenda, and we'll go to Senate Bill 1282. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1282.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 1282, and you should have the Dash 8 version of the bill from the Senate, specifies that a contractor who prevails in a dispute with the Department of Transportation concerning additional compensation on a contract receives their cost and attorney's fees. It also requires that the department approve or deny claims within 21 days and provide a hearing within 21 days if one is requested. Mr. Chair, members, the original bill applied to all state agencies but was amended in the Senate to apply to just the Department of Transportation. Passed the Senate on an 18-9 vote. I'll draw your attention to the Senate staff manager summary in your packet and to the fiscal impact statement that was also reported today.
Thank you very much. Now we'll call Mr. Kent and Mr. Sasser. And Kim Sasser also. Is there a Kim Sasser also?
She was here. And I imagine she'll be back soon, I hope.
Okay. Thank you. Please introduce yourselves to the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Kelly. I'm a contract administrator for KT Contracting Company here in Salem. We do work on federal public contracts, public contracts involving generally federal funds for highway improvements, road work, et cetera. And as such, our experience is primarily with the construction branch of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1282. In my capacity as a contract administrator for KT Contracting, in 2.5 years, I've experienced consistent and pervasive inability on the part of the Oregon Department of Transportation to administrate their contracts in a fair and efficient manner. And this primarily manifests itself in frustrations over receiving payment for work that's been performed and disagreements over payment for work that's been performed. And we have felt that it's reached a point where our frustration levels reached a point where we felt that legislation was necessary in order to give the Oregon Department of Transportation the same incentive that they impose and same requirements they impose upon their contractors to in pursue of claims and settlement of payment issues. To give you an example of one instance which has created what we feel the need for this type of legislation was a project involving the repair of the trunnion on the Columbia River Bridge, I-5 project, which occurred in September of 1987. That project was let for bid, and our portion of the contract, which involved primarily traffic control, was originally contracted for about $250,000. Immediately after the contract was let, the department realized that it had severely underestimated the amount of traffic control that was going to be necessary on that project and instantly began negotiations to expand the amount of work that we were going to be asked to do. Ultimately, the work expanded by about 500%, at least in dollar terms. The value of the work, our work, went from about $250,000 to about $1.3 million. And unfortunately, the timeline for completing that work did not change. We were still required. They had a time frame for closing the bridge, a date for closing, a date for opening, and some severe monetary penalties for not being able to have the bridge closed on time or opening on time. And so we undertook our work and pursued our work essentially while negotiations were still occurring. We believe that we had many meetings with the Oregon Department of Transportation to try to establish how that work would be paid for and just what was expected. We felt we had an understanding with the department on many issues. Unfortunately, after the work was completed, we found that there was many discrepancies, disagreements, and we had been unsuccessful in trying to get written confirmation or written agreement of those agreements that we had with the department. To compound our frustration, in approximately October, the bridge was closed and reopened during the month of September. And during the month of October, the department arbitrarily and without warning reversed $400,000 worth of payments to the general contractor, about $100,000 above which was KT Contracting's money. And so instead of receiving approximately $100,000 that we felt was coming to us, about $50,000, we suddenly found ourselves owing our prime contractor about $50,000. And again, this was without warning. We had no idea that this was going to happen. And upon investigation, found out that it was merely because members of the Oregon Department of Transportation hadn't completed their paperwork properly, and so they had to be resubmitted. And so the department took out the money until the paperwork could be done correctly. In December of that year, the department had paid us approximately $900,000, And, of course, we were still seeking settlement for other work that we felt we had done, payment issues. And the department essentially wrote us a letter and said, well, we feel all issues have been resolved. We paid you all that we feel we need to pay you. And if you have any additional problem with that or any additional claims, then you need to file a claim or pursue it administratively. That was in December of 97. Since that time, a year and a half has passed, and while the issues have not been completely resolved, the department has paid KT Contracting approximately an additional $400,000 for work that we had completed after, again, they had said that we don't feel we owe you any more money. Now, of course, interest has been paid on a good portion of that money, and so that has, of course, added to the cost of pursuing it. In obtaining that those funds, though, in pursuing that $400,000, KT Contracting has spent in overhead and personnel costs and other various expenses approximately $100,000. That money, according to the current law, current specifications, is not compensable to KT Contracting. So we have essentially lost $100,000 plus the amount of interest that we've paid on money that we have had to borrow on funds that we would have otherwise had received. We have spent that amount of money, and we're unable to recover that. Also, as I stated, the claims are still ongoing, so we're approximately a year and a half later from that December 97 date and still haven't fully resolved all the issues. So we feel that this legislation is extremely necessary, one, in order to get the department to be more responsive to the claims of contractors and especially the needs of small businesses such as KT Contracting, and also to hold them accountable as they hold their contractors and subcontractors accountable to certain timelines in the administrative claims process. Beyond that, I'd just like to say that I have noted a very stark increase. I should say that example is a stark example, but not a unique example. We have many issues and many problems on all of our on most of our contracts, and we feel that ODOT has more or less developed a very adversarial position with its contractors, and we have a great deal of difficulty getting them to address issues. They seem to have a tremendous amount of time to deal with problems or to find problems or technicalities or issues that will cause the contractor greater expense. But when it comes time to try to settle issues that involve payment or to try to get things, decisions made that might result in additional funds to the contractor, it seems that there's no time for that to be accomplished. So we do have a great deal of frustration and feel that this is both fair and necessary legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Carl Thatcher for KT Contracting Representative. I appreciate the time you've given us to address this law. The bill is important because it fulfills the intent of the existing law by giving it some teeth. The law says it is the policy of the state that all payments due on public contracts shall be paid promptly. I believe that we can all agree that a contractor's resources are somewhat small compared to the state. And I shouldn't say real world, but that's what we refer to it a lot of times, is the real world where you deal contractor to contractor and supplier to contractor. Issues like this are settled very quickly because we all realize that time is money, your overhead is money, and things become resolved very fast. Unfortunately, it seems to be the policy that maybe it's unwritten policy in some of the agencies that we can delay things if we put it off and say, that's out of our hands, and so they defer to higher levels. We would like for the contract to actually refer to settling things at the lowest possible level. We'd like you to consider adopting this bill because that would encourage just that. If an agency felt that costs were ticking for people to investigate these claims, perhaps they would deal more justly and expeditiously with their contractors. And I would like to emphasize and point out that it's mainly with the ODOT construction and the things. ODOT Maintenance is an exemplary, wonderful organization. I know it's kind of the same organization, but they're administered differently, and ODOT Maintenance pays their bills quite quickly. So we would like... So we're looking for fairness, and we're looking for the law to work. We're looking for the word promptly to mean something. And currently, it doesn't seem to be working properly.
Okay. Just add to that. I'm Kim Thatcher with KT Contracting, and I would like to also see this bill passed and just briefly add that it just stands to reason that if we only have a certain amount of time to respond to issues on a job, that ODOT should also have a time limit and not, get it buried under paperwork and not respond to legitimate claims. And meanwhile, the contractor is going out of business.
Questions from the committee? Commissioner Devlin.
For any of the witnesses, in the circumstances under which KT has had difficulties in payment, how many of those circumstances have been when you've been the contractor director contracting with ODOT versus a subcontractor, and your problem with payment has been with a contractor that's basically between you and ODOT?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, this is Michael Kelly for the record responding to your question. Our position when we contract with the state is generally always as a subcontractor, so I would have to say that pretty much all of the situations that I alluded to were when we were a subcontractor. Most of our contracts contain the clause that, of course, that the prime contractor will pay the subcontractor as paid by the state. So while our payment issues could generally be considered to be with the prime contractor, I can say also unequivocally that they're always a result of the state not wanting to pay for the work. It's not the state saying, well, we'll pay the prime, and the prime not wanting to pay us. It's more or less a pass-through situation where we're always essentially dealing with the state and negotiating or arguing directly with the state about these issues. We often, for formality's sake, we go through the contractor, prime contractor, we keep them apprised, we work with them, and the contract's required that they more or less certify a claim before being presented to the state, in other words, evaluate it themselves, but generally it always comes down to us negotiating or talking with directly with the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Thanks.
You're
welcome. Further questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much. Yeah, Representative Piercy.
I do have a question. When you're pursuing a matter legally, can you just kind of walk me very quickly through the process that you go through with ODOT and how far up you go? And because I heard you try to specify the difference between when you're working with different parts of ODOT. So I just would like to understand how you go through the process a little bit.
Absolutely. Again, this is Michael Kelly responding to Representative Piercy's question. The process, usually we try to resolve the process as informally as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The specifications that we are contractually bound to follow generally require us to put any concerns in writing and try to provide that either to the inspector or the project manager, which are the first two levels of the administrative process, and get them to evaluate the issue and to respond. Often we can resolve issues at that level.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, if it can't be resolved informally with the project manager, the specifications require us to file what they call a formal claim or administrative claim,
mm-hmm.
where we document everything, exactly what it is that we feel we should be paid for, why we should be paid, how much, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And we present that to the project manager for evaluation. If he passes on it, or if he denies it, then that is sent up to the region manager.
Mm-hmm.
From the region manager, it will go to the operations support section here in Salem. And then, depending on the size of the claim, will either go to a claims review board or directly to court, if need be.
So if I understand what you're saying, Chris, is that you feel you've had problems with enough consistency with this process that you feel like you need to have a hammer of your own, so to speak, here. And I'm just wondering whether you have gone up to complain in general about how there's some consistency in the lack of giving you the contracted amount, and that you are facing the same problem multiple times, and is there some way that you can work with with ODOT better so this didn't happen more as often?
Does that make sense to you or sincere?
This is Kim Thatcher. What do you mean by complain? Have we approached higher levels of kind of...
All I'm saying is I heard it's the process you go through, but if as you go through that process you consistently see the same problem occurring over and over again, do you take that as an issue to ODOT and say, well, we keep facing the same problem over and over again and we're asking for you to help us with this so that this doesn't continue to happen?
This is Kim Thatcher for the record. Yes, I have. I have approached, I've gone to, maybe not the proper thing to do, so to speak, but have gone to the Transportation Commission and a couple times in the midst of facing, in the midst of the situation of non-payment. And I have approached them with these problems and, anyway, we're in the midst of settling or going to a claims review board on this particular issue, and I'm sure it will be settled, but it is taking a long time, and I'm sure everybody at ODOT could agree that it's been an excessively long time as well.
Thanks.
Further questions? Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Conklin.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gary Conkling. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, and I'm handing out a printed testimony that indicates that my name is Lori Long. She was actually going to appear here today, but is ill, so I'm filling in for Lori today. You probably would have enjoyed her testimony more than mine, perhaps, but in any case, here I am nonetheless. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on this bill. I might note that EGC represents both open and union shop contractors, about 250 of whom contract with the Oregon Department of Transportation. EGC has worked closely with ODOT to maintain specifications for the dispute resolution process currently used by ODOT. Standing committees made up of industry members and representatives of ODOT have worked together to maintain open lines of communication regarding how the process works. Any changes to the dispute resolution process would be more appropriately handled, in our view, through these committees where issues of concerns to both sides can be reviewed thoroughly. We just noted in our testimony a couple of specific concerns with the bill as we read it. One, the 21-day timeline might work for many claims, but for fairly complex projects, it may be just too short of a time. Additionally, while there's a requirement that ODOT will pay prevailing attorney fees to the prevailing party, there's no reciprocal relationship. And in fact, as we try to balance these processes, we wouldn't want to find a situation of where ODOT found it was just better to reach settlement get the matters behind them. While we appreciate the intent of Senate Bill 1282, and certainly we understand and can in many ways relate to the experience just described a moment ago by previous witnesses, we can't support this bill and would recommend instead that a review of concerns go through the process that has been in place and has worked fairly well to achieve a balance between the contracting community and ODOT. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Mr. Hawkins, did you or one of the members of your organization testify on this bill over in the Senate?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we did not, and I think because we didn't completely take note of it. So, I'm sorry, we didn't, but it just came to our attention.
It appears, Mr. Conklin, that this problem has been around for a while, and that if people have a right to be paid, they really do have a right to be paid. And we'll hear from Doug Sandoz from ODOT here pretty soon, but that... do you have any idea why this hasn't been resolved before having to get to this level?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not the right person to comment about the specifics of this particular situation. The the contractor and the agency or the people to talk about it from a first-hand point of view. And again, we're not trying to be people raining on the parade, but many contractors have had issues with claims in the dispute resolution process. And the point I'm trying to make is that we've worked fairly hard with the agency through a series of ongoing discussions to try to improve and modify those as we go along. And a good story can prompt a response of trying to help, and I appreciate that. And these contractors, for all I know, may have a situation that requires some attention. The question, though, is should you amend the statutory process or a statutory control of a process to respond to a single situation? And what we're saying is that you might at least consider the option that we have used to arrive at the resolution processes that we have in place today.
Further questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Doug Kendall.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, good afternoon. Doug Kendall, maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'll try and keep this brief. We have two concerns about this bill. Mr. Conkling covered one of the primary ones, I think. Well, he covered them both. I think it covered the primary concern that we have pretty well. It subverts the claim process that we've worked hard with industry to put in place. The time frames may not allow for adequate review, particularly on complex claims or on claims that are not well documented. And certainly, those sorts of time frames don't allow for establishment of a claims review board, which is the last step in resolving a claim issue. The second concern is that it's not equitable, and it's not equitable in two ways. The way the bill's written, a contractor could file a $1 million claim, and if $1 of that was found to be owed to the contractor would then have prevailed, and ODOT would have to pay all of the attorney's fees. Even if the other $999,999 were not found to be truly owed to the contractor. And the second case, as Mr. Conklin pointed out, in not being equitable, is that if a contractor files a claim and then that claim is frivolous or unsubstantiated or otherwise invalid, ODOT may incur costs and attorney's fees which the contractor would not have to reimburse. So those are the two primary concerns that we have. Secondarily, I think, as Mr. Conkling has pointed out, too, the bill removes the incentive for ODOT to settle claims because once they get above the project manager level, anything that we do is going to, anything that gets resolved, we're going to end up paying all of the attorney's fees for, and so it's probably going to be to our best interest to let it go to court. In summary, I think ODOT pays based on the documentation that we are provided. I think that's good public policy to make sure that we have documented, because we have documentation that supports the payments that are being made to contractors. We endeavor to do that on time. And there are occasions when there are claims, when there are disputes, and I think that's inevitable in the construction business. Thank you.
Mr. Tindall, why does it? Why do we hear testimony saying that the maintenance division of ODOT does very well while the new construction end does very poorly?
Chair Simmons, I'm not sure that you would hear that universally. There is a different set of specifications generally used for a construction contract because we have more. They're generally bigger contracts. Maintenance contracts are usually relatively small contracts that are, I think, a bit more clear and a bit more well-defined in terms of not running into something you don't expect. So I think maintenance would be, I guess I'd characterize it as simpler type contracts than construction, and so I think you run into simpler type issues on simpler type contracts.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? That's Ms. Kersey.
My question would be, if a contractor feels like there's a pattern of not getting paid in a timely way and they feel like they've used the, gone through the process the way that they're supposed to go, starting at, as they talked about, the lowest level and kind of working up. If they think there's a pattern of where something is wrong with the way the process is working, what do they do about that? Where do they go?
Chair Simmons, Representative Piercy, we try, and again, as Mr. Conkin pointed out, we try and maintain relationships with the industry so that we would like them to feel that they can come to the construction engineer and with the concerns about the process, if there's a flaw in the process. I think that ODOT has concerns anytime we hear people that are raising issues, but when you have generally, I guess when we will go out and work out the solution we've worked out, we did it with industry input, and while any particular company may come up with a particular event where they don't feel that the process works, generally industry feels that the process works okay. But the input would go to the construction engineer ultimately. It should start with the project manager, region manager. Everyone should be aware because there are multiple reasons that something could happen that is contentious.
Thank you. So if a particular contractor time and time and time again felt like they were not getting paid in a timely manner and they wanted to identify or get some response to that particular issue, they're not saying that they've got a valid claim or an invalid claim, they're just saying the way the process works, there seems to be some problem with it. They would go to the
Chair Simmons, Representative Piercy, the construction engineer.
Okay.
Chairman Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kendall, do you know how much ODOT spends on AG fees every year?
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, generated that number for Senator George, and I can't remember what it was. I can get that for the committee, though.
Fair to say it's $7 million.
I think it was I think it was on the order of 2.5 in a biennial.
Follow up. Yes, Mr. Starr.
If this bill were to pass, would there be, I assume you'd have to endorse more litigation, more costs, that money would come out of ODOT's existing budget. Is there a potential that there'd be less money available for blacktop and those kinds of things?
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, yes. And it's a simple answer to that question. If we had to pay every time a contractor prevailed, we'd be paying a lot more fees to attorneys.
Thank you very much.
Further questions from Mr. Kendall? Okay, thank you very much. Yes,
Mr. Chair, is this bill brought by a concern from one contractor or by multiple, or what?
That's a good question, and I thought we would go into work session just talking about that a little bit. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1282 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1282 and Ms. Senator Piercy. I don't know if this bill was brought by one particular individual or one as a result of one particular problem, but there has been an ongoing pattern of problems. I have not spoken with the sponsor of the bill, Senator Shannon. No, that's right. But it would seem appropriate to me, at least at this point, to ask that the proponents and opponents sit down and visit a little bit and see if they can bring back something that's a bit of a compromise and work out something that addresses some of the needs, that have the problems that have been pointed out. Yet does it in a manner that isn't punitive and is allowed to work. The 21 days may be a little bit short. So Any other thoughts from the committee?
Representative Edwards. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something I'd like to know a little more about is why the bill got amended down to ODOT. And I don't know, maybe staff would give us a little more background as to the Senate amendment versus the original bill. Because I read the original bill, it was all agencies.
Do you have any information on that?
I'll try to find out for you, Mr. Chair. I didn't listen to the Senate meeting, so I'm not sure myself. And perhaps the Department of Transportation was the proponents of the bill.
Maybe the ODOT was the agency that appeared to have the worst problem. Further questions or comments from the committee? What I'd like you to do, and perhaps the folks from the KT contracting can work with Senator Shannon, perhaps, or meet with the folks from ODOT and Mr. Conkling and see if something that can be worked out that is a little more functional for the agency. 21 days is a bit of a concern to me, and then report back to me very quickly. This is getting on toward the end of the session, and if things are going to move, they're going to have to go very quickly. So that will close the work session on number 1282. We do have a work session scheduled on 28:30 today, but we will be setting that over. If anybody who's here for that issue, for that bill specifically.
28,
pardon me. Let's go down to 3629 now. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3629. Senator Shannon, did you want to come up and say a few words about...
Did the other people come to testify for us?
Well, pardon me, I believe you.
Yes.
Okay, I will reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 1282. Senator Shannon.
Thank you. My name is Marilyn Shannon, Senator in Senate District 15, and I'm in another hearing with Senator Durker, so I'm sorry I wasn't here earlier. But we've heard from many contractors around the state. In fact, we have another bill over there now that we've been carrying because they are trying to work it out between ODOT and contractors. And I'll just tell you, last week, a man in my district who lives on, has business on Portland Road, ODOT came to him and said, we need to widen it here and could we buy some right-of-way from you, or do we want to give it to you? And can you give it to us? And they said, well, we have three accesses. If we still could have, and this is just in the last 2 years, if we still could have this access, then we'd be happy and we'll give you the right-of-way. And the point is that, and I know this is about access and not another contract, but so many times, now they're saying to this businessman, well, when we gave you those curb cuts and the access, we really gave you what's the right to ask us for access. And if you don't like what we're doing, then sue us. And ODOT has these attorneys at the Attorney General's office, and I'm just tired of our gas tax money going to pay attorneys. And if ODOT, in my opinion, would have to pay some of these fees when they do lose, because there's, I can tell you many cases where they have lost, but it's no big deal to them, because I really firmly believe that there's a feeling not with the ODOT employees, but with the governor and some of the Transportation Commission, but not the employees, because I have great respect for them, but that it's kind of like any place but the roads. Roads is not a high priority. And so I that's why I introduced the bill. I listened to all these contractors.
I think it is a great bill. I know ODOT's saying that if they lost even a dollar or $10, they have to pay the other attorney fees. And I think this would be an encouragement for them to work it out and not always say, just sue me. We've got deep pockets. And there's one man that is in Albany that they sued, and they wouldn't then honor the court order. And so then a judge had to say, if this isn't done by 10 o'clock, and finally that day at 10 to 10, they did what the court said. And I don't know how else to deal with their high-handedness. It's just to say lose or pay. That's what the bill's about.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Senator Shannon? Or do you escape?
Thank you. I asked a question just before we closed the hearing. Why the bill was amended down to ODOT? I know that was the person who introduced it on behalf of had a concern with ODOT, but the bill initially talked about all state agencies. Can you give us a little background as to why it got narrowed down?
Narrowed down because that's where all the contractors and the complaints were coming from, and the attorneys and the lawsuits were ODOT. And that's kind of the committee I chair. So that's the stories that I heard. And so that's why it is ODOT. I wish we had a looser pay, but we don't. So at least the fees, I thought it was fair.
Thank you. Okay. Are there further questions?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you for coming over. We'll close the public hearing now on Senate Bill 1282, and we were in a public hearing or work session on 3629. And what we'll do today is make sure the most current amendments are introduced and on the table. And let's discuss those amendments. We do have...
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'm committee members. Update on HB 3629. The dash two amendments that are in your packet represents the entirety of the amendments for this bill. It incorporates the dash one amendment, and it limits hepatitis to the B and C type and incorporates the word state of Oregon in addition to any other political subdivision. And this seems to be the compromise that was worked out. And excuse me, also 5 years has changed to 6 months.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the dash two amendment version of the I've got a Hammond book copy of the bill, but I don't have an LC version of the amendment for those available.
We'll have them for
we will be coming up to the environment. These are worked out by the party to the agreement.
Yes, with
yes.
Mr. Chair, who worked out these amendments?
That's what I'm asking.
Oh.
Pardon me. Do you have any parties to the amendment here available? I'd like to step forward for a few minutes.
Mr. Chair, the reason I asked for the Hammond for the dash two amendment is on the Hammond Gross version between lines 20 and 29, whereas in Gross, you have B and C, I, A, W. I have no clue what that
is.
And I just asked for reading B.
My apologies. Little Perry coming out in accordance with.
I have so I can understand it correctly.
Okay. You were part of the of working out the dash two amendment to 3629, and there was a question that was presented to me about burden of proof. Can you elaborate on your discussion coming up with changing the clear and convincing to a preponderance?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I'm with the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also a firefighter here in Salem. In regards to your question with the dash two amendments, as per the last public hearing that we had on it, there were some concerns with some of the members in regards to the preponderance of the evidence. Currently, as was noted in last time's testimony, preponderance of evidence is now the way the bill is. There was what 3629 would do would make it a presumption with clear and convincing, meaning that the employee would have the benefit of having it be work-related. What we decided to do, since there was some concerns about that, wanted to come down. Still, we needed to have presumption, so we went from presumption of clear and convincing down to a preponderance of the evidence. We did work with some of the other people. However, we, for the record, and it, asking Representative Byer, we did not work closely with some of the adversaries or opponents that of this bill. We did not work with them. I do not know what their position will be. I had some brief discussions with them in regards to that. Most of what we worked out with the bill was to bring some of the concerns that some of the committee members had down to still allow for a presumption, but not at the highest level. In fact, at the lower level, something kind of in between, if you will, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Byer?
Is there a fiscal impact statement issued on this bill?
Yes.
When I inquired with both revenue and fiscal, revenue is not tracking, and fiscal says with minimal, so there's an additional statement.
Mr. Chairman, the room. We're in work session. Was that correct?
Yes.
I was going to ask questions of counsel. Was that fiscal Bem's analysis on the dash two amendments or the original bill?
I was always confused with the amendments. I did not specifically ask him. That was at 2:05 this afternoon.
Sure, I have a hard time believing it's going to be a minimal fiscal impact when you include the state of Oregon along with other political subdivisions. If one or two corrections workers end up with hepatitis B or C, the state of Oregon is going to have to be bearing the cost. And also, if we are going to be charging, or is this going to be bearing the cost to whether political subdivisions, if it's a local mandate, we would have to pay for that also. So if I can believe that it's a minimal impact, the testimony received in the first committee hearing from the insurance agencies, the insurance companies specifically states, it said that it could be an enormous amount of cost upon them, and that cost would then be in turn transferred over to the employing unit.
So it perhaps would be appropriate to check with fiscal before we do any further work on this bill, and get an updated fiscal on that would be specific to the dash 2 amendment. Thank you, Mr. Rosenstein. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3629. We'll go on down the agenda to House Bill, Senate Bill 606, and open a work session on Senate Bill 606. Okay, where did we leave this?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 606 and the Angle Stewart's version from the Senate redefines podiatry to include treatment of the ankle and behind the ankle. The hearing was held on May 27th. We heard testimony in favor from podiatrists and heard testimony in opposition from the Oregon Medical Association and the Orthopedic Association. So the letter at your place today to enter into the record from a number of parties opposed to that work assistance as well.
Alrighty, thank you very much. Members, we are in work session on
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Are there any proposed amendments? Because when we last read the bill, the Medical Association had proposed amendments to the bill. Representative Garvin just told me he thought they were through this amendment, but I was under the impression some of the people at the Legislative Council have that drafted.
I am not aware of any amendments coming.
Chairman?
Yes.
I just draw the committee's attention to a letter that I believe was directed to the chairman on the 1st of June. At least my copy that I received from my office by fax that day, a letter from Scott Gallant where he states, the OMA respectfully requests or regrets that we are not able to reach an agreement with the proponents of SB 606. So I don't believe there are any amendments forthcoming, Mr. Chairman. I think they attempted to reach some agreements or they had discussions about it and reached an impasse.
I believe that's accurate. Not to my knowledge that there are any further amendments coming to the bill. And we have the bill before us. Is this in the Star out in the hall yet? And Welsh has put that also. Mr. Barrows, are you aware of any further work being done on this bill? Take a step forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, Members of the Committee, Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. My understanding from talking to Mr. Gallant was that the issue wasn't that we couldn't come to agreement, if they could not come to agreement within their own organization between the OMA and the orthopedists to find something that they could all agree to offer us. So we were never really, we never saw some language because they couldn't come to agreement themselves.
Okay. President Byer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barrows, as I wrote down the proposed amendments the other day as Mr. Gallant offered them, were you in a position that you were able to take a look at that proposed language and agree, disagree, agree, disagree, or anything?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, we were trying to write those down, check them, look at them. At that point, we understood that the orthopedist that was there would not buy off on them, and so Mr. Gallant was going to try and find something else, try and work out something to offer us, and was unable to find something that they could agree to present to us. The language that was discussed briefly on the when he was on the stand, we've had some concerns about it, but we had never really got into a discussion because they couldn't come to agreement themselves.
Well, as I wrote it down, it basically stopped the new language after the word ankle. It put an ankle, and then it, on the new section 4, it deleted subsection 1 of section 4, and it was subsection 2. I don't know if I have a bill in front of you.
I apologize. I didn't have a copy of section 4. I've got one back there if you'd like me to.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, not having had a chance to really run that through our organization because it wasn't really offered to us. We, in our discussions right there, part of it looked like it would work, part of it we weren't sure about. We wanted to get more discussion from. But for us to, again, kind of dilute the bill as we've done over the last three sessions, we wanted to get a guarantee that then they would be okay with the bill and they couldn't offer us that. So at this point, we were sort of in a position that this is the bill that the Board of Medical Examiners has said is acceptable. So this is sort of what we'll go with, I think. Not having an opportunity to go back to the board and ask them if it's okay with them to make those changes, because they were the ones that wanted, I believe, Section 4, Sub 1, in a hospital or ambulatory surgical center, written into language, into the statute, rather than left up to rule.
Mrs. Gardner.
I'm Mr. Chair, in light of that testimony, I guess I'd like to move Senate Bill 606A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there a motion to move Senate Bill 606A to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Byer.
I personally thought that the proposed, verbal amendment offered by Mr. Gallant would have been a good addition to the bill. It basically would have said, the podiatry physicians can work on feet and ankles. I think is what the proponents of the bill want, and other than that, it was kind of going to leave it up to the Department of the Board to make the decisions beyond that. The part about being in a hospital versus an ambulatory surgery center, it probably makes sense to have left that in the bill, not taking it out of Section 4 the way it was. The way it is now,
I think I'd be a no on the bill the way it is now. I think the bill could have been defined a little bit more just by saying foot and ankles and eliminating the tendon verbiage, and I think everyone would have been happy.
Okay. Further discussion? Did you want to propose a conceptual amendment to the bill, or do you want to just let it go?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we have an amendment for a motion before us. So the maker of amendment would have to. And I hate to do that without having the giving them a chance to study the issue and exactly what it says. But that's what I was hoping there was an amendment here.
But there's a comment on that, Mr. Barrett, before we go to vote.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Dr. Peterson to comment on the specifics that were discussed
very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer. The intent of the board in that specific amendment was to require that the ankle procedures be performed in a hospital setting or an ambulatory surgery center to ensure that there be an oversight and quality of care issue. And that's what was the reason for having it in the statute.
Intended issue. Dropping tendon out.
Yeah. Drop the tendon out. The problem with tendons is that's one of the major procedures that we're already doing currently. And that would basically go backwards in time from the standpoint of what we have. A lot of the procedures require tendon work in order to complete the ankle work as well. So if you do one, you can't really worry about the other one.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Brown?
I think so.
Okay. Kevin, please call the roll.
Representative Atkinson?
Excuse.
Representative Beck?
No.
Representative Byer?
No.
Representative Bedlin?
Excuse.
Representative Edwards?
Yes. Just to move this process along, I need more time to look at this between now and the floor.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Beck?
Excuse.
Representative
Tracy?
Yes.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Welch? Aye. Representative Wood? Okay. Aye. Representative Bill 606 votes before the due pass recommendation. Representative Gardner, I see the carries.
Love to.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Beck?
At the request of Representative Devil and I, who's absent, I'm sure notice for a possible minority report, but I would not be carrying it. I still may vote for myself, but probably not.
Who would you be joining with
Representative Devil,
who's not here?
You don't have to be present here, but he wanted me to serve notice.
Okay. All righty.
So we have
We have a carrier for the bill, and we will close in the yes.
The record show. I won't be joining.
No.
You're looking forward to that.
Right. We will then close the work session on Senate Bill 606 and go to the next item on our agenda, which is Senator Lim is here. Let's jump down to Senate Bill 950 and open a work session on Senate Bill 950. Colleagues, we heard this bill once before, and thank you for stepping up, Senator Lim.
Thank you.
Thank you on work session.
Mr. Simmons again, and I'm ready to answer any questions, but we have more than 100,000 patient Americans in our state, and then this is a great thing for them to participate in the state. And this will bring you more economic development. Mr. Chair and members, I have Class 3 amendment here. Instead of making a month, it's just the third week of May is the Asian American Heritage Week instead of month. So if you could approve, I think that will be a great thing.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on the A3 amendment?
You want a motion?
President Starr?
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 amendment to Senate Bill 950.
Colleagues, we have a motion for us to move the A3 amendment to Senate Bill 950. Is there any discussion? Representative Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be opposed to the motion, the bill, and everything else.
I won't object to the motion to move in the amendment. But.
Okay, is there any other discussion on the A3 amendment and the motion to move it into the bill? Mr. Rose, please call the roll.
Representative
Hickson? Excuse. Representative Beck?
Aye.
Representative Byer? Mr. Chair, are we voting on the motion to move the amendment now?
Motion, yes. That is correct. This amendment to move the motion to move the amendment into the bill. Right.
I'll let Ray show. I said I wouldn't object to that motion.
Okay. Cause of motion for us to move Senate Bill 950 as amended by the A3 amendments to the floor of due pass recommendation. Any discussion? President Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't support the bill. I would like to, I wish I could remember the exact, you know, speech that Representative Mannix gave last time we heard this bill, but it's exactly that. Besides my objection, I mean, I would like to show that not that I don't think that Asian Americans have not had great contributions to our state and our country. That's not the case at all. My objection to this bill and is just the opposite, that everyone who lives in this country somehow came from somewhere else, and we all could claim, if we claimed a week apiece, we had every single week of the year. It doesn't look 52 weeks. There's a lot more countries and nations of origin and ethnic groups out there than 52. We could all be claiming one, and then where would we be? This is a feel-good legislation that does, it probably does more to divide the country and divide the different racial groups than anything else, and I just think it's the wrong way to go.
Thank you very much, Mr. Representative Barr. Any other call the roll, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkinson?
Excuse.
Representative Beck?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
No.
Representative Devlin?
Excuse.
Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Mannix?
Excuse.
Representative Kirshen?
I gladly vote aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Walsh?
Aye.
Aye. And Senate Bill 950 moves the floor to do pass recommendation.
Sure.
And yes.
If there was a bill I was going to give a minority report on, this would probably be it.
It's noted, duly noted for that.
I will not make that statement.
Representative Pierce, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd be glad to carry it.
Okay. I'm sure you'd be the carrier. And that concludes the work session on Senate Bill 950. And now we'll go to Council 2989. Yes,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the staff major summary that I have for you today is a -2 set of amendments. It replaces the entire bill. Those of you who looked at the -1 set, the only difference is that in the -1, the Adult and Family Service Division was named to be an interim state agency for this operation, and that has been changed to an option of the governor. Now, as to what the bill does, it establishes a board to be appointed by the legislature and by the governor to consist of at least 51% of members of business to oversee the development of a workforce program in Oregon designed to integrate the delivery of various services to people who need jobs and job services and other public assistance programs such as food stamps, temporary aid to needy families, and others. It also sets up throughout the state what are called workforce investment areas. Counties can join. More than one county can join with another county to become a workforce investment area, and they can later opt out of that. The city of Portland is also named as a workforce investment area. The fiscal, I do not have a fiscal impact statement on the Dash 2 amendment, but a similar bill, 3203 with the Dash 7 amendments, was substantially similar to this with some important differences. But those differences do not, in my opinion, change what was given as an indeterminate fiscal impact on that other bill. So I would say to you it's my expectation that there'd be no revenue impact and an indeterminate fiscal impact. I have ordered the statement on the Dash 2, but don't yet have it.
Call Cam Poose Brawley.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Cam Poose-Brawley. I'm the governor's workforce policy advisor. And with me is Verlina Cosley from the Employment Department. She's the director. Michael Buckley from Adult and Family Services. And Roger Bassett, the commissioner for community colleges. They have asked me to deliver this message, and given the hour, that's probably a good thing. I will be brief. House Bill 2989-2 is, as Mr. Putman said, comes from House Bill 3203. Since March, the governor's office and these workforce partners have worked with proponents of the bill, endeavoring to find language that was mutually agreeable. We have been unable to do so. As Mr. Putman also said, this is state legislation that would implement in Oregon a piece of federal legislation that was passed this last fall. Our concerns with the bill include the fact that House Bill 2989-2 limits the governor and the state board's flexibility to design and deliver a workforce development system that meets the needs of Oregonians. Does that in three specific ways. Limits the membership on the state board, Section 3.2. Limits the governor's role in designating workforce areas at Section 4.3, putting at risk Oregon's ability to receive federal workforce training dollars.
Do we have this in writing somewhere?
Certainly. Yes. It also appears to direct the state board to identify a single agency that would be responsible for all things deemed workforce, without regard to other effective or efficient means of state administration, and that's Section 3.5b. It also limits the flexibility of local workforce boards to design and deliver workforce services to meet unique needs of those areas. It limits the scope of local decision-making in that area, Section 5.2 and 3 and 4.1, and it limits the ability of local boards to prioritize the use of funds for services that might be needed in their community, and that's section 6.3. In conclusion, there is no need for state legislation to implement this federal piece of law. And there is certainly no need to implement a piece of legislation that limits from the outset Oregon's flexibility to implement the law. Therefore, the governor's office opposes the language contained in House Bill 2989-2. Happy to answer any questions.
All right, Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, you said this somewhere, someplace, you quoted a section that limits the, what was the word you used, the flexibility of the local boards. I'm trying to figure out exactly where you crafted there to come up with that interpretation.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, particularly looking at sections 5.2 and 3, where it indicates that a local board can ask a state agency to provide contracting services, that currently in the federal bill would be a local board action. So it's moving to the state level, a contract that is best handled at the local level, adding an administrative layer and removing direct participation of the local board. Also, section 4.1,
you've lost me again on 5.2. I can't see that anywhere in 5.2.
Mr. Putman.
Cam, I'm not on the same page of the song book either. 5.3 is intensive services for drug and alcohol.
You're right. I'm sorry. Let me find it, please. Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, okay. Section 5.2 requires local areas in their one-stops to provide timely listings of subsidized and unsubsidized job opportunities that is not part of federal legislation and could, in fact, be a burden. If you look then further at Section 6.3, line 20, it says that there will be a contract for and overseeing one-stop services, including core intensive and training services. Those are things that have been given to the local board rather than to a state agency in the federal legislation.
Mr. Beyer, maybe I have a different version, but my dash 2 on line 20 says may contract for and oversee one-stop operator services. I don't think that's a mandate, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the same language is used under Section 3C, line 26, where it says that the state board shall create a single state agency that will, you move on, line 26, execute and oversee contracts with specific performance criteria through a competitive process as directed.
Go down just a little bit.
Where are you?
Section 3.
What page?
Page 3.
Page 3.
Line what?
Line
26 through 29. So execute and oversee contracts for one-stop operator services, including core, intensive, and training. And those are all activities that are directed to happen at the local level through contracts at the local level.
Mr. Chair, the subsection 5, section 3 is referring to things that the state board shall report to the governor and the legislative assembly on the operation of that. That's not mandating we'll do that. That's a study and looking at the opportunity and the feasibility that they do that. The board shall report to the governor and the legislative assembly on October 5th or by October 15th, 2000 on one of the things is the creation of a single state agency that will. It doesn't say that they're going to do that. It's going to do a report on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, we have a different interpretation of how directive that piece is in this statute, or in this proposed language.
Mr.
Chairman, the new participant in this process, looking at this particular bill, I think Representative Byer's interpretation is quite accurate. And for the record, if there's any question about the interpretation, we're making it clear for the record that this has to do with the report and the description of the creation of the single state agency. When we get down to Section 6, line 20, that may contract for language, we need to read the next sentence, beginning on line 22. This section does not restrict the authority of local workforce investment boards to select providers and one-stop operators or to set goals or policies under the Federal Act. So, reading the piece as a whole, I don't think there's anything that's non-copacetic. Just one of the tips in making a record, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
President Kersey.
I guess I have to go back to page 3, because when I read this, it says, the board shall report to the governor and the legislative assembly on the creation of a single state agency that will, as one of its things to do, execute and oversee contracts with specific performance criteria for a competitive process. They will do that as directed by the local workforce investment boards, blah, blah, blah. But they're the ones that are in charge, sounds like to me. That's how I would do it.
Within that,
even if that was read as a directive, the language on page 6 is more specific. It talks about a non-restriction. I think if you take it as a whole, it will be well understood. I don't see, Mr. Chairman, I just don't see this provision as creating this agency, but reporting on the creation of an agency. And perhaps Representative Byer can help me with that if I'm misunderstanding.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer. That's the reading of it that I have, that I read, but I don't believe we anywhere in this proposed amendment are we granting the State Workforce Investment Act or board the authority to create a state agency and then have that state agency carry out the directive. This sort of says in sub 5, the board shall report to the governor, and that's one of the things they will be reporting on is the creation of a single state agency. Nowhere are we empowering them, that board, to build a state agency.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, that's a clarification we were unaware of.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Maddox?
Are we going to be working on these today, or are we just talking about them today?
We're talking about them and trying to smear ourselves with them a little bit today, and we have a number of other people sign up to testify on this. Some of them, like the majority of them are here.
Can I make a recommendation?
Yes.
If we want to clarify, we can easily say the board shall report to the governor on the, this is page 3, line 16. The board shall report to the governor and the legislative assembly by October 15, 2000 on the status of implementation of the federal act and shall make recommendations as to, colon, and then start breaking down. Then it's clear.
You get that, Chief?
Chairman.
Lieutenant Gardner.
Yes, just one quick question. Is any of this necessary to implement the Federal Workforce Investment Act?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, no.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Do any of the rest of you wish to testify today?
Mr. Chair, Berlina Crosley, Director of the Climate Department. My only portion of testimony would be that you have letters in front of you from two people that I've been asked to bring to your attention. One is the chair of our advisory council, and she has two letters to you, one as a chair of the advisory council and one as an employer who uses the system. And Gwen Harvey, who actually is on the current Charging Workforce Advisory Committee and is also on the advisory committee. They have raised at least four issues, and if you have other people, I'll just list those. There was significant discussion in the prior committees on is part of the service delivery strategy that the employment department uses currently on suitability and work attachment. The third area is conformity, which there are some questions regarding the contracting out in this particular draft, and a single agency, which is now being talked about. So those are in their testimony and ideas.
Questions. Any further questions from the committee?
Crosley, in the letter from the Advisory Council and your testimony about job attachment, where in the dash two amendments is there any reference to job attachment as a policy?
There,
if it's there, I've missed it.
It is not there specifically. However, the information that has been brought as part of these amendments, and she referenced earlier the dash 6 and dash 7, there was prior testimony on the record regarding those two strategies. And what they're basically concerned about is that the intent of the new language as it goes forward, that there be an articulation of whether or not there is an intended change in the service delivery strategies.
So just for clarification, there is nothing in this amendment, the dash 2, that deals with job attachment.
I've not seen that particular language, but there was some, trying to think about what page that has that, because there was some that at least raised that concern again. On page 5, section 5, sub 2.
Page.
Page 5, section 5, sub 2, where they talk about the timely listing of subsidized and unsubsidized to participants of the one-stop system. Right now, that is not done for people who are work attached. So if that is going to be a new requirement, that would be a change in the service delivery that is currently not done currently. It is only done for non-jobs.
Any other questions from the committee? All righty. Thank you very much. Mr. Fletcher.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Eric Fletcher, Oregon AFL-CIO, but more importantly, probably for purposes here, is a member of the Employment Department Advisory Council, and I would direct your attention to that council. We are in the minority. It's composed primarily of businesses, and in looking over 3203, which is a predecessor of this, I don't see a great deal of difference, really. The same concerns are there with the council. This is a solution in search of a problem. There isn't a problem with the Workforce Investment Act being implemented by state. I think the governor is doing a fine job. The current council is doing a fine job. And I see no reason for this legislation. A couple of concerns, and then I'll stop. Again, I would interpret that the Section 5 just referenced to would put in jeopardy the current standards that we use for attachment and suitability. And the testimony on 3203 clearly was the intent, as I recall a question from Representative Gardner. One of the participants that was testifying said that if you were a journeyman electrician and were out of work and drawing unemployment insurance, he thinks that you would be required and should take a referral to a subsidized, unsubsidized job, even though you may be waiting to go back to work with the same contractor. I think I'm paraphrasing you correctly.
Yeah.
And I still see that you could interpret that section of that to do that. Or if it were a plywood mill that may have had a temporary stoppage due to a small fire or something, and those employees were out for a week or two, they would be provided with the listings as I read this. And probably encouraged to take them. I don't see any reason for it. Lastly, the Oregon AFL-CIO and Associated Oregon Industries joined together in 1993 to ask the legislature, and the governor agreed to create a separate department for the employment division. And now we are talking about creating a lead agency apart from that to do work of what I think the department is doing fine. I see no reason to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions, Mr. Fletcher? Thank you. Thank you.
Is anyone from the county here today who wishes to testify on the DASH 2 amendment to House Bill 2989? No, Mr. Chair. Okay. All righty. We will then close the public hearing on House Bill 2989, and we will adjourn.
Thank you.
Yeah.